Benedict and Olivia were throwing some stuff out there that was picking up. But his past work is The Favorite with Olivia Colman. They produced, co-produced it also, Benedict, and Poor Things. He had worked on both of those. So you can kind of get an idea, his off sense of humor. I will say right now that I will say he's going to get nominated for an Oscar. I'm going to say that right now. He's going to win or not, that's a stretch, but the screenplay category is still completely uncorrupted by the Academy, and they tend to notice good work, and this is well-deserved. You mentioned that if you want to see it, better hurry, because at least in theaters now, they're about ready to both vanish.
Thanks, Jeff, and we will talk anon.
Thank you.
Okay. And now I'm going to...
And thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching the screens.
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross from KGUA FM, Walla, California. When I'm in Portland, which is often, I listen to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
KBOO's loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will take place on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios in North Portland. The meeting will include a state of the station presented by KBOO's Board of Directors and an opportunity for members to meet the candidates running in the board election. KBOO will introduce its 2026 to 2027 operating plan and will present its first Diane Carl Mentorship Award. New directors will be announced at the meeting, followed by a musical performance by Mr. Vail's math class. Again, KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will be held on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios, located at 3939 North Mississippi Avenue. Doors open at 11 a.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/board25.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Tabor Space, presenting their End of Summer Fest benefit concert Sunday, September 21st from 1 to 7 p.m. The event will feature an afternoon of live music and a craft fair. Tickets and info at taborspace.org.
You're listening to Let's Talk. Let's Talk is a digital space for students at PCC experiencing disabilities to share their perspectives, ideas, and worldviews in an inclusive and accessible environment. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions or positions of Portland Community College, PCC Foundation, or KBOO FM. We broadcast bi-weekly on our home website, pcc.edu/DCA, on Spotify, and monthly on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM.
And welcome, everyone. My name is Asher, and today we have a very special guest to talk about accessibility in gaming. Hi, Matthew. Can you tell me your full name, who you are, your pronouns, and what your occupation is?
Yeah, well, hi, everyone. First off, just thank you so much for having me. This is such an awesome opportunity. I know y'all are doing some really great work covering just a bunch of really interesting and impactful issues. So my name is Matthew Kreuter. I am the current director of learning and engagement with an organization called Games for Change, which I know we'll talk about in a little bit. I use he, him pronouns, and I'm currently living in New York. It's like a fun fact.
That's awesome. It's so great to have you here. Thank you so much for accepting our ask to speak on one of our topics on accessibility. So tell us, what is Game for Change, what their mission is, and how did you get started with them?
So Games for Change is an ed tech-ish, play-based learning-ish, just educational broadly nonprofit. We're based here in New York. Our mission really is just around leveraging the power of games. And this can be video games, tabletop games, in-person games that kids could play, learning games, just games as a broad category, and other interactive media that really sits in this world of play to drive some kind of positive social change. So often that means using a game for learning, but can also mean using a game for advocacy, using a game for lifting up different voices, or just addressing some kind of social issue broadly. A lot of what we do aims to empower creators, educators, innovators, lots of cross-industry people to use games to address local issues or even critical global issues. A lot of the work that we do sits around things like poverty or education or human rights, global conflicts, climate change, and really thinking about how games and play can be used to bring some joy or bring some change or bring some positivity to a lot of those issues.
That's awesome. How did you get started with Games for Change?
I guess I'll just do sort of my entire background, because it's a bit of a winding road for how I got here. So I'm still relatively early on in my career, but let's just say earlier on in my career, I was a software engineer. I was a computer science major. I worked in a variety of tech and tech adjacent industries, coding, and I really did not enjoy it. I have the utmost respect for people who do. I think there's a lot of really awesome stuff out there, and a lot of the work that we do does hinge on coders and developers, but it just really wasn't for me. The biggest part about it was that I did not feel like I was having the kind of impact that I wanted to. It just felt like I was typing and then committing that code, and maybe it had some impact on the tool, maybe it didn't, and often the stuff I was working on didn't feel impactful anyway. So I made a pretty big pivot from software engineering into teaching. I did Teach for America, which is a two-year teacher sort of residency program without any kind of education background in particular. I got my master's in secondary education, and I taught middle school math for 2 years. So this is really where I guess my real career started, where I'm taking these technical skills, product-related skills from software engineering, educational skills, and perspectives on various industries from teaching, and then bringing them into the field that I currently work in, which is nonprofit education. The big reason there is that I finished Teach for America right as the pandemic was starting, and virtual teaching was just extremely difficult for me. I think it was for a lot of people. Again, have the utmost respect for people who stayed in teaching during and through the pandemic and obviously are still teaching now. I was moving across the country at the beginning of the pandemic. I was thinking about, what do I want to do next? Do I want to keep teaching? And the idea of starting at a new school virtually, it just really wasn't going to work for me. So I thought, okay, what would be impactful right now in the summer of 2020 as it relates to education? The obvious answer that I think a lot of people were attaching themselves to, myself eventually included, is some kind of virtual education or virtual community spaces. So I went from teaching to another nonprofit called Connected Camps, where I did product development, curriculum design, things like that, for a large suite of Minecraft-based educational classes, communities, learning tools, all virtual, all game-based. And then from there, joined Games for Change. So really translated computer science and product skills into teaching skills, into ed tech skills, into now nonprofit advocacy around the power of games for education. So very long and winding road.
That's really cool though. Oh. I have so many questions with that. You mentioned Connected Camps. What is Connected Camps? Can you walk us through it?
Yeah. So they're still going. They're a nonprofit based out of Southern California, and they still run a wide variety of virtual education programs in Minecraft. I think some fun examples, they have classes in Minecraft around cell biology, history, virology, architecture, business, things like that, with the main goal of taking something that we know kids are interested in this case, Minecraft, and leveraging that interest to help them become interested and learn something new. So if a kid's already interested in Minecraft and you are hoping that they build some additional interest or passion in the business side of architecture, then they could take one of our programs, Architecture Business in Minecraft, right? If you think that they're interested in perhaps pursuing some sort of future in science, they could take a cell biology course. But it's like rooted in this thing that we know they're really excited about. We know they have some mastery in, which is Minecraft. We know it's a really great tool for exploring creativity and design and things like that, and sort of transitioning that into this building of interest in some other topic. Some of the other work we did, this is no longer running, but something I'm still very proud of, is we had a Minecraft-based community for grieving youth, partnered with another organization called Experience Camps. So again, this was like birthed out of the pandemic, where they have in-person summer camps for grieving youth, but it was tough to get everyone there with the pandemic going on, and people were a little worried about sending their kids off to summer camp, even in the years following 2020 and 2021. So they really wanted a virtual option for these kids who are disproportionately affected by feelings of isolation or loneliness, or feeling like no one around them understands what they're going through or really gets it. We worked with them to build this community in Minecraft fully virtually for kids around the nation and some globally, but it was tough with time zones, to just come together and be a part of this virtual community that I think our tagline was, everyone here gets it. They sort of understand not exactly what any individual is going through, since grief presents in its own unique ways for each kid, but there's like this shared thread of like understanding a broader experience. So I'm very proud of that project as well.
So cool. Oh, I wish that was still happening. I feel like a lot of people, especially in our generation now, could use something like that to be able to connect with other people, whether it's through gaming or just through a community of people who are going through the same thing. That's very cool. Going back to the topic of accessibility, where did you find your drive to start advocating for accessibility, whether it's in gaming or in what you do?
Yeah, so solidly in the middle of that long winding road of my career when I was teaching, I was at a public charter school in St. Louis. It was a tiny, tiny school where the middle school actually was 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and each grade only had one class. So I was the math teacher for the 5th graders, the 6th graders, the 7th graders, and the 8th graders. And they just rotated from class to class. It wasn't like there were multiple 5th grade classes or 6th grade classes. It was just the 5th grade class, the 6th grade class, and they just sort of rotated. So I had 4 preps, which is crazy. But this idea of accessibility became very, 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 very clear when I was the one watching them and tracking their growth from 5th to 8th grade. And I think my largest class was my 5th grade class, which was 31 or 32, which I think is the legal maximum in Missouri. So they really packed it. This is just so prevalent across any classroom, let alone just a very small charter school in St. Louis. Not every fifth grader in there across all 32 was at an exact fifth grade level in math. I had some kids who were testing at like the 9th or 10th grade level in math, and I had some kids who were testing at the 1st or 2nd grade level in math. So this idea of accessibility as a function of, I have this fifth grade curriculum, That's what I'm being measured by my school district, which is another conversation in and of itself. Like, how do I create a classroom where in my 50 or 55 minutes, whatever, per class, all of my students, from the students who are still kind of just struggling with basic numeracy, all the way up to my student who's like, anything you throw at him, he just understands, he just like really gets math and grasps things really quickly. How are they all accessing something that fits what they're ready for, what they're excited about, what they're interested in learning, in a classroom with 32 kids and one teacher, wanting to find different structures, different scaffolding techniques, different ways to engage my students with technology, because like, technology can be a really, really great tool in that setting to help me help them or reach them. That's where like this idea of like accessibility, not necessarily in the context of video games, but we'll definitely get there as my sort of like career and interests progress, but just accessibility in general, like accessibility for students, accessibility for learners and like teaching techniques. That's where it became like this very poignant issue for me, because I could see that it was just such an issue for me to try to solve somehow in my class.
Yeah, no, I feel like that's very important. There's so many different levels, even if you're in a classroom. People are in different areas of expertise, whether it's in math or English or science, what have you. I feel like especially in the gaming culture, you're going to have people who are just started gaming and people who are advanced or pro at it. But then there's also people in the in between. So to be able to reach all those different facets, accessibility is also very important, especially for our collective. We reach out to people who have disabilities who aren't necessarily able to hold onto a controller, whether it's a gaming controller or whether it's a keyboard, or they have certain motor functions or they're not able to see and they rely on their hearing and all that sort of stuff. Some developers such as Ubisoft and Extremely OK have been lauded for their accessibility and customizations, while others such as Nintendo and From Software have been criticized for having limited to no accessibility implementation. For a studio that doesn't provide a plethora of customization, what should be the bare minimum that they could strive to accomplish?
Yeah. So this is just like my personal opinion, sort of separating myself from speaking on behalf of Games for Change, because we have some broader production guidelines for how we might support different people with playing different games. But just for me, like, it is a very, very difficult issue. I think a lot of these game studios, especially when we're looking at like a very small indie studio, there are so many different needs of this wide range of people out there that it can almost be, for an indie developer, just overwhelming, right? It is overwhelming to create a game, to market that game, to find your niche in the blooded games industry, and also have your game be highly accessible. So what I really appreciate in the industry that's like just bubbling up and growing right now is that there are other organizations, and I'll name a couple that I think are doing some really great work, but other organizations that are helping to provide guidelines, helping to provide technical support, and then helping the players themselves discover games that have accessibility features that work for them individually. So three in particular, there's an organization called Able Gamers. I think they've been around for upwards of 20 years. And a lot of the work that they do is in the physical technology. So they're supporting a lot of the physical technology that allows for different players with different accessibility needs to engage with a game that itself did not have accessibility features built in. They're building adaptive controllers. They're creating televisions that work better for various levels of vision. Like you mentioned, if there's an issue with deafness, they're building some kind of, they work based on like vibration through parts of your bones instead of actual sound waves. So they're doing a lot of great work just supporting with creating auxiliary technology that supports gamers with disabilities instead of the games themselves having those accessibility features built in. Because at the end of the day, if I'm making a game for the PlayStation has a particular controller. If there's a person out there that physically cannot use that controller, it doesn't matter what I do in my game, like it's not going to be accessible. So there's this layer of what physical technology are we providing to people? Yeah. So they're great, Able Gamers are great. There's another organization I think called Good Trouble Games. They have a few things going on, one of which is this repository called Able to Play, where they essentially just have this long compendium of different games. It's like a games discovery platform that tells people what is good about that game in terms of accessibility. So you as an individual, you create this profile with the platform, it identifies what accessibility needs you might have, and then it matches games to you based on what might work best for your needs or your abilities. Then another website is very similar to that, Can I Play That? So again, they do like accessibility scores. I just appreciate that there's these other organizations that are approaching this from a different angle, which is a lot of these big games just aren't going to do this, which is like problematic in and of itself. But if they aren't, how do we still support people with finding games that do? I think there probably should be just some like bare minimum accessibility features around something as basic as subtitles being on by default instead of off by default. Certain things around color, allowing players to remap or rebind all of the keys. I know that's a really big one. It's like for certain games that don't allow any keybind remapping, that's just such an easy low-hanging fruit for a studio to do that might allow someone with some sort of hand or other digit mobility issue to just bind the keys in a particular way that works for them. So there are a lot of really simple things that I think most studios just should be doing. But beyond that, I'm sure there's a much longer list of much more complicated features that I hope some of these other organizations like Able Gamers or Good Trouble Games are like helping to build a framework for, since that would not be like my personal area of expertise for the leveled up features.
I appreciate you sharing all those different organizations. I feel like reaching out to them would be a great resource as far as looking into what kind of games are accessible for yourself. I totally understand the idea of subtitling for a game. I wish there was a function where you can switch on or switch off subtitling, especially if you're trying to listen into lore or NPC talking or something like that. There are times where, even for myself, I don't really have a disability. I just can't really understand very heavy accents at all. And I need that help to be able to understand what's going on. Like, wait, what did he say? Or something like that. How much do you interact with developers directly? And I know you answered this a little bit, but what are some guidelines that you have for your developers?
Yeah, so I personally don't interact with developers at all. Not something that I do. I know like on the Games for Change side, we support executive production needs. So sometimes like an organization might say, I really wish I could make a game for my particular audience about, let's just use grief as an example. We would support them with this matchmaking process around finding an actual development house or development organization that can make a game. And we would sit as like the middleman between this organization that wants a game made, this organization that can make games, and helping to like translate back and forth, seeing as the organization that wants a game made has no experience with games and the organization that wants to make the game probably has no experience with grief. So we would sit as a middle expert helping to translate back and forth. A lot of what that would then mean as a carryover for accessibility is looking at this organization that's an expert in grief and all of the accessibility issues that might come with that, like disproportionate feelings of isolation, this need for the people around them to have some understanding of what they're going through, potentially like access issues based on the person they lost is a primary caregiver. There might be issues around like how they can engage with the game itself or when they can do this, and translating that to the game development studio to say, these are the things that you would need to be aware of that you aren't normally aware of when you're making your game. You need to be aware of these trigger words that might be relatively fine for a general audience, but might mean something totally different to an audience of students that are grieving. You might need to be aware of these different conventions of how someone might play a game. But I think in terms of the support that we or anyone would want to provide to a game studio of how to make games accessible, the thing that I'm really highlighting here is that it should come from the group that you are trying to make the game accessible to. So again, I'm not sure if grieving youth is the best example in terms of accessibility, but continuing to use it, it should come from experts or kids themselves that are grieving about what accessibility features you might need. Similarly, if you're trying to make a game that is highly accessible to people with color blindness or some other impairment of their vision, the guidelines of how you make that game good should come from experts or the people themselves who have that vision impairment, right? I think that's a piece that's very much missing in the games industry. It's just like, let's just
slap something together.
We could probably figure out what might work for color blindness just by Googling it. Maybe at the most baseline level, but probably you would want someone on your QA team to actually have experience with this particular accessibility issue so they can actually give you feedback on whether or not the approach that you had to solving that issue or to supporting that issue actually works compared to like just Googling, how do I make my game more accessible for someone colorblind? You're going to come up with some answers, but I think the piece that's missing is like having advocates from that group themselves really support you with development. So again, it's like a lot of work can go into that for a game studio, but it's great that there are organizations out there, in our case, Games for Change, like helping to do some of that translational work where studios are building a better understanding of how to make their games accessible with different groups in mind.
For sure. I feel like entertainment in general have that mindset of we're just going to slap something together on this topic that we don't really know anything about, rather than finding someone who actually advocates for whether it's a disability, whether they're blind or deaf or hard of hearing, or they have mobility issues, just so they can make the game a little bit more personal and actually reach the audience that they're trying to reach. On that idea, what are some games and studios that you feel really deserve some recognition for their accommodations?
Yeah, so I'll go back to a couple that I mentioned earlier, mostly because they are platforms for people to find games with like reviews, accessibility reviews, essentially. So I want to stray away from being that game developer, I suppose, that just tried to make large pronouncements myself about like, oh yeah, this game studio is really great for people who are hard of hearing. I have no idea, right? I'm not hard of hearing. I have no idea whether or not a game studio actually is or actually isn't. So the two platforms that I mentioned earlier that I think really support some of this would be Good Trouble Games, their game studio themselves. Like a big focus that they had was creating games that were highly accessible, but a game studio itself can only make so many games and they're only making games that they're interested in. So whatever genre of game that is, there's a million other genres that they're not making games for, but that they wish players could play. So they created this platform, Able to Play, which again is just like a personalized matching platform for people to find games that are accessible to them based on this personalized score that they help to make with the platform. Another one called Can I Play That? I think there are a lot of studios out there that broadly people would say they're doing a good job. I think you mentioned Ubisoft and another one that I had actually never heard of. I think it was Extremely Okay. Never heard of it, so I'm going to look them up. But I think the biggest thing is Ubisoft is not lauded for so many other things that it's like there's organizations that are doing good work around accessibility. And there are certain games that Ubisoft has that probably has some good accessibility features. But it's such a unique problem person to person, based on what exactly their accessibility need is. Or even for you, like you mentioned, it's not that you have any vision or visual impairments, but you just appreciate having subtitles. You don't have any hearing impairment. You just appreciate having subtitles to help you visually process the information that's occurring. So having platforms that really, really care about this and really, really want to help you find games that work for you, instead of just saying, I don't know, just go play one of the 200 games that Ubisoft has published, some of which have horrible reviews because they've like really watered down the franchise, or some of which have great reviews because they hit it out of the park. It's like, well, I don't even know, does this game have subtitles? That's the only thing I care about. It's really exciting to see that some organizations, again, Good Trouble Games, Can I Play That, are approaching this from a very personalized lens where any individual can say, I would like to find games that have subtitles. And it'll recommend like this long list of games that like fit whatever your accessibility criteria are.
That's very cool. Yeah, for sure. Do you yourself play games in general? Do you have a favorite game that you like to play?
Yeah, I play a lot of different games. I think the game I'm playing most now, there's like a new season of it. Actually, it came out today, so I'm excited to try it later. It's called Teamfight Tactics. So this is under the Riot Games IP, like an offshoot of League of Legends. Some other games, I really, really enjoyed Baldur's Gate 3. That was a big one, I know, for a lot of people, but that was, and still continues to be, I think, one of the great games of the last couple of years. But yes, I'm an avid gamer myself, and so these issues are very near and dear.
Yeah, for sure. I personally love to play the Banner Saga series. That one in particular has a great mention on subtitles where you can actually toggle on and off subtitles, which I really love. I've played it over and over for years. And then I have also been starting up on Persona 5, which the Persona series is great, and I love the game in general. So going back to Games for Change, they recently hosted, well, not recently anymore, but I feel like it's been a couple months at this point, a Games for Change festival in New York. What was it about, and will it happen again next year?
Yeah, so it was earlier this month, so still relatively recent. It was last month. Wow. The summer, wow. It was last month. It happens every year. So we have our festival in New York City every year, pretty much every summer. It is this giant cross-industry conference, festival, expo combination where we bring a wide variety of different people across the industry. So people who are in game development, people who are in education, people who are in tech, people who are just in nonprofit or impact work in general, just various industry leaders together to have talks, workshops, that sort of thing. So kind of like your standard festival slash conference idea, but totally focused on the future of social impact gaming, VR, XR, AR, all of these game adjacent things. We bring industry leaders in to talk about them and to have workshops about them. And ideally for all of our attendees, they learn something or they build connections or they network, and there's some progress that is made, some growth and opportunities that are created for people to continue doing this work in social impact gaming or play-based learning. At the festival, we also have our Games for Change Awards. So I know you were looking through and you had mentioned one of the games, Arise, A Simple Story. We have our awards where we go through and we pick some of what we think are the best social impact games or XR experiences broadly of the year, with a specific focus on highlighting creativity, innovation. In the case of Arise, like really powerful storytelling, an interesting use of games as a media for doing something more than just creating a fun experience. So more than just play, it has to do something impactful, whether that's a really powerful story, whether that's bringing some sort of advocacy to a global issue. It's just an opportunity for networking, community building, some very standard like conference pieces where we have speed networking and just different opportunities for our attendees to all meet each other, to forge new connections, collaborate. That's a large part of it as well. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. The Arise, A Simple Story. Me and my producer, we played it and loved it so much. So stay tuned. Actually, after this interview, we're going to be talking about it a little bit and getting into it. But thank you so much, Matthew. Do you have any like final thoughts that you want to give to our listeners as far as like accessibility in gaming or anything about Games for Change or about you in general?
Yeah, well, thank you. This was really great. I'm, again, just so honored to be asked to come and share some of my thoughts. But I think broadly, like when I think about accessibility as it relates to the games industry, I think there are a lot of different ways it can go. The ones that like immediately pop into our heads that we focused on a lot during our conversations were around the more commonly known or more stereotypical almost access issues, things like hard of hearing, vision, physical like dexterity with your hands, being able to use controllers, being able to access games because of language barriers or things like that. But there are also like access needs around income, right? So when we think about video games, there's this huge component of the games industry that is gated behind income or socioeconomic status. It's like not easy to become a game developer. It's not easy to start an indie game studio. It has all of these issues in the industry as well. There's accessibility issues that are solved by games. Like games can be really great at solving accessibility issues based on location. So if you have this desire to be on a sports team, but you're very rural and you just don't live near a place that has a sports team, there's really nothing you can do. But if you just have this desire to be on a competitive team of some sort, even if you live in a very rural location, you can be on an esports team. And it's this opportunity that you can have as a student where locational accessibility is made possible by the fact that games often are fully virtual. Similarly, there's a level of accessibility that games as a baseline allow for. You might have students who just for whatever reason are not able to play soccer or are not able to play a traditional sport or are not able to be on a traditional sports team. They could be on an esports team. There are potentially certain competitive outlets that might exist for them in esports, even though traditional sports are not physically accessible to them. So these layers of accessibility that exist in the games industry, and there are different organizations that are doing different good things around each of them: income accessibility, locational accessibility, baseline accessibility of just being able to play the games themselves, and then deeper and deeper and deeper into, is this game accessible for folks who are hard of hearing? Is this game accessible for people who have issues with dexterity? Is this game accessible for people who have issues with vision or colorblindness? It just keeps going, keeps going, keeps going. So we talk about accessibility in the games industry. I think, again, it's really important to just listen to individuals themselves that are experiencing these accessibility issues and then trying to come up with interesting, creative, innovative ways for your game or for your tool or for your feature to help work with as many people as possible, or very, very specifically target one particular group and help them really, really well. But there's all these different ways that the games industry approaches accessibility. It's not just these high level ones of accessibility things that you think about or disabilities that you think about. But again, examples like income or just location, I think are really, really interesting accessibility issues that games can support with by virtue of being fully virtual.
Thank you so much, Matthew, for your final thoughts. Appreciate you coming in, and I will hear from you guys next time. This has been Accessibility in Gaming. My name is Asher, and thanks for listening in.
That was a short interview with Matthew Kay, Director of Learning and Engagement from Games for Change, on the subject of accessibility gaming, and you're listening to Let's Talk. I really appreciated the insight and how many resources there are out there for people with disabilities to play video games and connect with others through that new medium. Next up, we have a short on accessibility in Hong Kong. And once again, you are listening to Let's Talk.
You're listening to Let's Talk. Let's Talk is a digital space for students at PCC experiencing disabilities to share their perspectives, ideas, and worldviews in an inclusive and accessible environment. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions or positions of Portland Community College, PCC Foundation, or our community partners. We broadcast on our home website, pcc.edu/DCA, on Spotify, on X-Ray 91.1 FM and 107.1 FM, and Cable Community Radio 90.7 FM.
The views and opinions expressed during this podcast are those of the speaker and the research they conducted abroad. They do not necessarily reflect the opinions or positions of Portland Community College, PCC Foundation, or the PCC Accessible Education Resource Department. There are some overwhelming noises to those sensitive to loud sounds or are suffering from hyperacusis. Listener's discretion is advised.
Allow me to take you on a journey across the globe. A city full of culture, good food, history, and is always alive. Within the hustle of the city across the ocean that never sleeps, we will look into the accessibility for the life of the disabled. How they work, play, travel, and live life. This is Accessibility in Hong Kong.
Chance to travel to Hong Kong for a few weeks. Since I had lived in the States for a long time, I never really looked too closely at the disability culture in Hong Kong. I've lived here many times in the past, but never looked at life here with the lens of someone with a disability. What if I'm hard of hearing or deaf? What if I'm blind? Or what if I have a mobility issue or a learning disability? How do I work, play, and get around in this high-pressure concrete jungle called Hong Kong? My name is Asher, and we are about to find out.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Hong Kong. It is a safety requirement that you remain seated with your seatbelt fastened and citizen sign has been turned off. Please be careful when opening the overhead compartments, as items stowed inside may fall out. Can you take all your...
Upon arrival in Hong Kong, the airport is expansive. But luckily for me, every sign has English words along with Chinese characters. There are also tactile guidelines on the floor for blind users to get around, as well as airport security who could help direct anyone lost.
Hong Kong has a whopping 7.4 million population, all of various nationalities that have migrated here to try living in this fast-paced city of Asia. Spanning 1,104 square kilometers of territory, it's split by a bit of ocean, from the mainland to the downtown part of the city, Hong Kong Island. It is also the fourth most densely populated region in the world. Below the towering skyscrapers, the city is filled with all kinds of stores, food, clothes, branded goods, supermarkets. The city is really a consumer's paradise. I took a walk along the busy streets where everyday people do their grocery shopping. The sounds here are deafening. There's so many people. It's so crowded. And the footpaths here are really narrow and not very accessible. Despite that, the produce sold here, fruits, vegetables, and dried wares, are really cheap in comparison to US prices. As of June 2024, the exchange rate between the US dollar and Hong Kong dollar is approximately 1 US dollar equal to 7.81 Hong Kong dollars. Hong Kong maintains a currency peg since 1983 to ensure financial stability and trade confidence, which keeps the exchange rate between 7.75 to 7.85 Hong Kong dollars per US dollars. Buying about a basket of apples, which consists of 5 apples, costs only about 50 Hong Kong dollars, which is equivalent to only 6 US dollars, compared to US prices where a kilogram of apples costs anywhere between $2.35 and $4.46. Besides the street side stalls, there are many indoor markets that are known directly translated as grandma's market or a wet market. It is more so a wet market in every sense of the word. The wet markets here in Hong Kong are much like their counterparts out in the street. Narrow, busy, and a lot more people because of the lower prices. However, here you can buy fresh fish still swimming in vats of water, freshly cut poultry, and other ingredients. The prices here are even cheaper than those of outside. There aren't many tactile guidelines on the busy streets of Hong Kong. They're mainly found in the city, some malls, and public transit centers. But when you ever do cross the street in Hong Kong, you most likely hear this. The crosswalk signal turns on automatically without needing to press a button, but there is a button if you need extra time to cross the street. You typically don't want to try to cross a zebra crossing if you can avoid it, as drivers here in Hong Kong don't yield to pedestrians, but rather it's the other way around. As for traveling, the sound you heard just now was the tapping of a transit card to pay for transportation fare. The card is known as an octopus card, and you can use it not just to pay for transit, but to pay for everything. And I mean everything. This one card, you can top it up and use it to pay for your bill at a cafe or buy a sandwich at a convenience store. You can even use it to make big purchases at a supermarket. This one card can do it all. The main form of transportation here in Hong Kong is the train, called the MTR here, a bus, or my favorite, the minibus. The minibus is basically a small school bus that goes around in a specific area, much like a regular bus, but in a much smaller circuit. The other difference is that, unlike a bus, where you can press a button to signal your stop, "Stop at the school, please," you need to call out your stop. You can tell the driver in advance where you want to stop, and they'll stop for you. Also, there are some minibuses that now have a stop button, but unless you know where the stop is, you'll keep going until someone else calls for a stop. The Hong Kong train stations, otherwise known here as MTRs, are of all different shapes and sizes, with many entrances and exits that can leave even the most local residents confused. There are large maps within the station, with English guides telling of the different entrances and exits, and where you'll land if you come up from an underground station.
but there is something especially special for those that are blind. This special little tune can be heard in most MTR stations, and it's quite loud over the usual busy hum. It's a small metal stand with a detailed tactile map of the station, along with braille descriptions of the entrances and exits on it. There's also a big red button here. I don't want to press it because it would probably call for someone to come and help you if you're really lost. For ticketing gates in the train station, Hong Kong has installed these new gates that have a flap that opens and closes rather than using a turn wheel to get through. There are also larger ticketing gates for those that have luggage or use a wheelchair. Mobility culture is quite a big thing here, where even if you use a wheelchair to get around, ramps, elevators, and accessible walkways have made it so traveling is easy. There's even a place to charge your electric wheelchair in the station if you need to. That's actually really cool. Getting into the train station, you can ask for help from a train attendant who holds a booth along the platform. Need a ramp to get on the train? Or need help finding an elevator to get to the concourse level? All you have to do is ask. If you come to Hong Kong looking for really traditional food, the street-side restaurants and cafes are the places to be. Sometimes, the cramper and the louder, the better. These stores aren't typically accessibility-friendly. With cramped narrow spaces and needing to rub shoulders and backs with strangers, sometimes even heated arguments break out amongst customers and the store owner, adding to the overwhelming atmosphere. There are great restaurants that are more accessible in malls that also have great food. Bigger malls have monitors and physical guides and directories to help tell you what kind of stores and restaurants there are, and if you're lucky, they can switch from Chinese to English with just the swipe of a finger. The afternoons during the high tea and rush hours, especially during the weekends, is when the most people are out and about, bringing the hum of the city to a chaotic fever pitch. In today's day and age, having a digital device is important when traveling around and on the go. Using your phone's map can especially make things a lot easier when traveling around. And scanning a QR code for a menu in a restaurant is a sure way to help users who need to use a screen reader. In this busy and fast-paced environment, it's so easy to get lost, or even get in trouble. This is all just what I had managed to explore while going around Hong Kong. After a search on the government's website and talking to some friends, there seems to be a lot more going on than what I had initially thought. According to the website, disability in 7.4% of the overall population has a disability, with approximately 39.1% of individuals with disabilities working. From what I understand, the definition of persons with disability extends to the elderly. The fact being that the rapidly aging population here in Hong Kong means that most people with mobility difficulties or other forms of impairment are becoming the majority. According to the Hong Kong Free Press, quote, by 2041, almost one in every three Hong Kongers will be 65 years old or above, end quote. The government has services and support for persons with disabilities. According to their official government website, there is a list of rehabilitation services, vocational rehabilitation services, transport and access support, and many other support links that people with disabilities are entitled to. In addition, people with disabilities and their family members or carers may apply for free delivery services offered by supermarkets in Hong Kong, with an application form provided by the Labor and Welfare Bureau's website. Despite this flowery outward exterior, according to some residents, things aren't as good as they may seem behind the scenes.
An anonymous individual who works as a kindergarten teacher told me about their experiences working with children who have disabilities and special needs. I asked them about how students with disabilities in Hong Kong are treated, and their response was that unless the student is completely disabled, meaning they are completely deaf or hard of hearing, or they're fully blind, are they placed in a special school. Otherwise, they go to the standard public school, where they do get their education needs met, but it's done through extra classes, which take up their recess time. She also stated that it's very difficult to get into these special schools, as you need to take exams and assessments in order to get in. In a standard school, there is some equipment provided and funded by the education department. The education department is the main organization in Hong Kong that focuses on the education from preschool all the way to college and university, along with the hiring and training of teachers and instructors. Equipment that would help in a classroom that the organization can provide could be an electronic magnifier for students with low vision. However, the student must also take assessments as the machine itself is expensive, and in order to maintain the machine, the student or parent will have to either pay for someone to maintain it or maintain it themselves.
If you decide to visit Hong Kong, chances are you'd end up living in a hotel. But if you're like me, who have parents living here, you'll probably end up staying in their home. Residential homes in Hong Kong are pretty different from those here in the States. For one, many of them are these high-rise apartment blocks that go up to 30 floors, and each floor has about 12 units, so you could very well hear what your neighbor is doing. There's also not as much space in each unit. Like my parents' home, here in Hong Kong, the total square unit of the entire house, a living room, kitchen, a shared bathroom, and two bedrooms, is about 484 square feet. Because of that, big appliances aren't normally bought for small apartments like these, which means no dishwasher, so everything is hand washed, and even if there is a washing machine, there's no dryer, so clothes have to be hung out to dry. And there's no bathtub, just a standard standing shower. As you can guess, such small spaces are not accessibility friendly, especially if you need wheelchair access in and out of the house. But if it's a must, residents have made innovative ways to make living in these small apartments work. There are private houses in some of the older districts of Hong Kong, but those are few and far between. As land gets more and more scarce, it also becomes more expensive to own a home. Nights like these, hanging out with my family in front of the TV is the best, in my opinion, despite all of that. Even though eating out is a pretty big thing here in Hong Kong, it is typically cheaper to buy groceries and cook at home in our tiny one-person kitchen. The term "too many cooks in the kitchen" was definitely applicable when I tried to help cook for my family. Rice is a big staple in Hong Kong household, and it is usually served with a vegetable dish and a protein dish. On special occasions, we would make some soup to have before the meal. As for nightlife, people tend to go out for drinks and explore the city skyline. But for me, I would spend hours into the night talking to my family about life in the States, eating snacks, and cracking open a beer or two. There are many places you can go to explore. Some are accessible and some are not. I would recommend going to the more newly renovated and built areas, like this place I had the pleasure of visiting in Hong Kong.
Up the sideline, now the pace required, given back to the big man, Motunathagi. Infield, now options everywhere. Fijian magic here in Hong Kong. Try for Satoranga.
Kai Tuk Stadium. A multi-purpose sports venue at the site of the former Kai Tak Airport in Kowloon, Hong Kong. It opens its doors this year, 2025, in May, and seats up to 10,000 people during major competitions and events.
The architecture of the stadium is fascinating. The stadium is shaped like a smooth flowing ring that feels both futuristic and organic. Think of it like a giant circular amphitheater with a skin made of light metal and glass, cool, sleek, and strong, stretching wide and open to the sky. During the day, the stadium's walls seem to camouflage with the sky's backdrop in a gradient of color, while at night, the outside walls, which are actually made with something similar to LED screens, light up, basking the surrounding area in bright colors. The area has accessible walkways, ramps, and elevators to get to the lower floors outside, a garden space that overlooks the mainland of Hong Kong.
Hong Kong is widely recognized as one of the most digitally connected cities in the world. With some of the highest smartphone penetration rates globally, over 90% of the population uses smartphones and fast, widespread internet access. You'd expect that technology would be a great equalizer, but when it comes to accessibility, things are less advanced. Many public sector websites and apps still don't comply with basic web accessibility standards, like the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. These guidelines help ensure that websites are usable by people with visual, auditory, physical, or cognitive disabilities. But in Hong Kong, adoption of these standards is not mandatory. The government has published digital accessibility guidelines, but since they aren't legally binding, compliance is often inconsistent. For example, some official websites support screen readers or offer text resizing tools, while others are nearly impossible to navigate without sight. This creates a frustrating and sometimes impossible experience for users who rely on technology for basic services like booking appointments, paying bills, or online food delivery services. Most Hong Kong apps, whether for banking, shopping, or food delivery, are built with speed and design in mind, not accessibility. Features like voice navigation, keyboard-only functionality, or alt text for images are rarely included. Without regulations requiring companies to make their digital services accessible, there's little incentive for change. Language is another key hurdle. Many globally developed assistive technologies are designed for English language environments, which limit their usability in Hong Kong. Screen readers like JAWS or Apple's VoiceOver work reasonably well with English interfaces, but they can struggle with Chinese websites, especially those using Cantonese-specific content or layouts not optimized for accessibility. Even when the tech exists, access remains a challenge. Devices like braille displays, adaptive keyboards, or hearing aids can cost thousands of dollars. While non-government organizations such as the Hong Kong Society for the Blind or the Hong Kong Association of the Deaf offer subsidies, tools, training programs, and digital literacy workshops, the reach is limited, especially among elderly or low-income individuals with disabilities. For older adults who didn't grow up with technology, learning how to use a screen reader or navigate a smartphone can be overwhelming. And if there's no Cantonese language support built in, it becomes an even thicker barrier. There are, however, signs of progress. I had heard that some local startups and university research groups are working on AI-powered captioning, Cantonese voice assistants, and inclusive fine text solutions. For instance, projects at Hong Kong Polytechnic University have explored haptic feedback systems and gesture-based controls to help users with mobility impairments. But these innovations are often in early stages, not yet available for widespread use. Like every country, there are pros and cons to disability culture and accessibility. Thankfully, before I had left Hong Kong, I heard that an additional special needs school will be opening its doors to students who are deaf or hard of hearing. Whether or not exams or assessments need to be taken before admittance is unknown. It's heartwarming, however, that change is slowly but surely being made for the next generation. With the culture of high performance here in Hong Kong, it's people like my interviewee that can help those with disabilities and special needs be recognized in this bustling city that never sleeps.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's broadcast about disability culture. Find more information and resources concerning this episode and others at pcc.edu/DCA. This episode was produced by the Let's Talk Podcast Collective as a collaborative effort between students, the Accessible Education and Disability Resources Department, and the PCC Multimedia Department. We air new episodes bi-weekly on our home website, our Spotify channel, and monthly on KBOO Community Radio 90.7.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.